Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This week, we're listening to conversations between family members and friends who live right here in Appalachia. We'll hear from a woman working as a river guide.
Doesn't matter if you're in California or New England or South America, the water on a river is going to do the exact same thing.
And we'll hear a young woman share her story about one of the most difficult experiences she's faced, losing a loved one to a drug overdose.
If something could happen to someone where it was just the worst thing that possibly could happen to them, I think that would be it. I think that would be the worst.
And we'll learn about what happened when a young jazz musician first came to West Virginia in the 1960s.
I experienced integration in reverse because West Virginia State was a historical black college.
Today's voices were all recorded by the StoryCorps folks when they traveled to Charleston, West Virginia last fall. It's what's Inside Appalachia this week. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Oral histories aren't normally about big historical events, but about day-to-day life and the people who lived through them. Last fall, StoryCorps brought their mobile recording studio to Charleston, West Virginia, and captured dozens of stories from people across the region. These conversations were all recorded between friends, co-workers, and family members inside StoryCorps' silver Airstream trailer that was set up just outside the Clay Center. StoryCorps' mission is to preserve and share humanity stories in order to build connections between people and create a more just and compassionate world. We selected a few of those conversations for this episode of Inside Appalachia. This show will take us on a journey through time as we hear personal stories in Appalachia over the past 60 years. West Virginia Music Hall of Famer Bob Thompson moved to West Virginia from New York City almost 60 years ago. He came to the Mountain State to attend college at what is now West Virginia State University. He met adversity, fell in love, grew with his music, and learned about the people of West Virginia. In this first segment of our show, we'll hear Bob and his friend Larry Gross, the host and artistic director of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's nationally distributed music show, Mountain Stage. Let's listen as Bob shares his story of moving from the Big Apple to Charleston, West Virginia, and find out why he stayed.
So what did you know about West Virginia, if anything?
Nothing. I didn't know that there was a West Virginia at that time.
Like most people.
And most of my friends didn't. Because for years they thought I was in Virginia somewhere.
Yeah, of course.
The western part of Virginia. Okay, I can deal with that. But, you know, so when I came here, well, West Virginia was, Charleston area.
This was what year?
1960.
1960.
1960.
Okay, this was before Civil Rights Act. This is before Voting Rights Act. Before the world was somewhat different in a lot of places. And I'm sure, you know, the experience here was a little different than New York City.
Exactly.
Tell me about that. When you got here, how'd you come?
I came on the bus.
Okay.
I usually travel by train, but they were on strike. So I took a Greyhound.
All right. So you took the Greyhound, which takes you right downtown,
right
Charleston.
Right downtown.
Okay. You get off the bus, and what happens
next? I got off the bus, and I was hungry. So I looked across the street, and there was a little place called the Chuck Wagon. And I went over there, and I said, just like a hamburger and a Coke. And they said, okay. The woman said, yeah, you can have a hamburger and a Coke, but you can't eat it in here. You have to take it outside. And that was my first experience.
Okay. Welcome to Charleston.
Yeah, that was my first experience. But in all fairness, I was told that that was the last place in downtown Charleston that had that kind of policy. So. And that's the place that I went.
And then you had to head out to State College. What'd you do? How'd you get out there?
They have a cab.
A cab took you out there.
Okay. I figured, okay, it's right around the corner.
Yeah, not quite.
But it was quite an experience. In fact, it was during a time at the college, which was interesting because I experienced integration in reverse because West Virginia State was a historical black college.
Right.
And they had just started integrating. White students had just started coming.
Really? Yeah. In 1960? Because I know it was. And even in more modern times, it was more black than white. But now I don't know what it is. But in any case, I knew the legacy was there. So you were there when the first whites were being...
Yes. exactly.
This was a different day, around the early 60s, when there was a place in Charleston, the district they called the Triangle District, which was mostly black and which had clubs and so forth. So how did you work your way into that?
That's right. It was a very vibrant, you know, community, you know, both musically and, you know, businesses and things were thriving there in the Triangle District. Professor Thompson, one night he took me to a place called the Crazy Horse, which was on the west side of Charleston. And it was an after-hours place. At that time, liquor by the drink was illegal
right.
in West Virginia. So these were all, you know.
Clubs, quote
yeah.
unquote.
This was like, there was a gate. It was actually a big house. And there was a gate, and you went up and you rang the buzzer, and somebody looked out of a window upstairs, and then they buzzed you in, and the club was on the second floor. But there were jam sessions there that went on into all night.
Sometimes. Local musicians?
Local musicians, and people that came through town would always stop in. And so there was a constant flow of great players. And a lot of guys who were my age who went on to become great players came up through that scene. And as always, music brought all kinds of people together, you know, young, old, black, white. And that was what was great about it. Plus the willingness of everybody there to help you. If, you know, there was a piano player. And if I thought I knew a song, I'd say, well, can I sit in? And then he'd stand behind me and call out the chord changes to me. And then when he felt like I had it, he'd say, okay, kid, you got it. And he'd go sit down.
So what's the biggest change from that time to this time in music in Charleston? What would you say it is? That Triangle District is gone or what?
Right. That had a big impact, you know, when it became legal. And that forced all of those kinds of clubs out of the business because you had there were big license fees and things like that that you had to have. So, but a lot of us just moved into the other scene, you know, played in the other clubs.
Played legit.
Yeah. And so it was always fun. And the thing about it is that the musicians, you know, both black and white, all played together. You know, there was, you know, I know in other cities they had separate
right.
musicians unions, but not in Charleston. The musicians were always together, you know, and I thought that was, I took it for granted until I saw what was happening in other places.
Well, at what point, here you are, still from Jamaica, Queens, you're a kid, you're in college, what point did you say, I think I'll be here, I'll stay here? Or did it just happen and you didn't notice and then you were here?
Yeah, it kind of happened. I was going back to New York during the summers and then I was coming back, you know, for a while and then I started staying here, you know, and then, then I met a West Virginia girl.
Okay, I mean, I knew that would come into the picture at some point. It usually does. And so
yeah.
So you decided just to, and she didn't want to go somewhere else?
Right,
at first. Did you want to go back to New York and leave, or were you happy here?
I was kind of torn in between, you know, because by now I liked it here. I liked living here. I liked the style of life. I'd gotten used to it, you know,
yeah.
and a lot of things were different, you know.
Yeah. What did you like about it the most? I mean, that made you kind of tipped you over the scale.
Well, people.
Yeah,
people, the friendliness of people, the openness of people. You know, when I first came here, I would walk down Capitol Street, and somebody would pass me and say hi. And I was like, okay, what kind of game is this? We didn't have this in New York. What's high? What's that
what's
about?
What's going on?
You know? And but people, you know, I had several experiences, you know, that showed me where people were, you know. I remember once, and I may have told you this before, I was playing up at a ski resort, and I had a problem with my vehicle, and it was ended up being a broken tie rod. I drove into Elkins, and I drove into this garage. His name,
which
was,
is right in the heart of West Virginia mountains, and
that's right.
It's a small town.
Yeah, and went into Red Stalnicker's garage, and he told me what the problem was. And at that time, I just had a. It was so long ago. It was Bank AmeriCard.
Right.
I had this credit card, and he said, "I'm sorry, I'm not set up to accept that now, you know. And I didn't have a checkbook or anything, so I started out the door, and he came out and got me. He said, "Hey, but I'll fix your truck," you know. And he pulled it on back in there. He fixed it and said, "Whenever you get where you're going, send me a check." Now, he didn't ask my name, where I was from, where I was going, nothing. Just whenever you get where you're going, send me a check.
That was jazz pianist Bob Thompson speaking with Mountain Stage host Larry Gross. Their conversation was recorded in the Mobile StoryCorps booth, which was in Charleston, West Virginia, in the fall of 2018. That music break was Bob Thompson performing Duke Ellington's Take the A Train. Sometimes StoryCorps recordings are just about family and the little things like the love between a father and his sons. Next, we'll hear 9-year-old Liam and his 6-year-old brother Conrad ask their dad, Will, about his childhood.
How many times did you get in trouble?
How often?
Did your mom write that question?
Yes.
I was a pretty good kid for the most part. I'd get into a lot of trouble, but I don't have a malicious bone in my body. So the trouble that I would get into was just like kind of fun things, you know, playing little pranks on my teachers or my friends. And I got in so much trouble in high school that we had this thing when you got in trouble, you had to go and spend time with the dean at boarding school. He'd wake you up in your room at 8 a.m. Well, we were supposed to get up, but I'm not very good at getting up in the morning, as you know. So sometimes the dean would come and wake me up, and we would have to go and walk in circles around the campus with him for 2 hours on Saturday morning. And that was called guard. It was known as the guard squad. You'd go walk with all the other troublemakers. And I had guard pretty much every Saturday of my entire high school career. They would measure guard in hours. You would have so many hours of guard that you would have to work off, and they would deliver your how much guard you had on note cards to you at lunch on Fridays, and the note cards would all be attached to each other, and I could hold mine out and it would just unfold and hit the floor. It was so long. There were times when I had a couple hundred hours of guard, but like I said, you know, it was kind of fun. I got to be pretty close with the dean. We got to be really good friends, and he was a pretty neat guy. He was actually at one time the president of the National Geographic Explorers Club. He was an archaeologist. He'd been to the Arctic Circle several times.
Whoa.
He'd been to the Antarctic and had done all sorts of neat things. And had I not always gotten in trouble, I wouldn't have gotten to spend so much time with him.
Why did you think of our names?
Why did we think of your names?
I obviously know Conrad's and I know mine.
Well, Liam, do you want to tell us?
You were going to name me after 5 generations of William.
Yeah, but did you know that I didn't want to?
Huh?
Mm-hmm.
What did you want to name me?
I don't know. But I thought that it was maybe time to cut it off after. Have you ever met another 6th?
No.
Yeah, that's kind of a lot. And I sort of thought it was time to cut it off. But Willie, your grandpa, pulled me aside and said, "Let me tell you something. If that child is born a boy and you name it Bob or Tom or anything other than William R. Laird, I've never laid a hand on you, but I will beat you." And then your mom decided that we would call you Liam, short for William. And I was okay with that. I liked that. Conrad, your name is
after Nana.
No, it's after your Grammy. Her last name before she got married was Conrad. And your middle name, McNeil, is the same as your Uncle Paul's and lots Nana. Of people in our family. That's an old family name of ours, too. So both your names are very
special.
Kind of special historic family names to my side and your mom's side of the family. Thanks for coming and doing this with me. I really appreciate it.
I love you.
I love you guys so much. You make me so proud, and seriously, being a dad is it's my favorite thing in the world.
Please don't cry before this ends.
I wouldn't trade it for anything. I might.
No, please don't.
All right. I love you guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was brothers Liam and Conrad Laird speaking with their dad, Will Laird. Their conversation was recorded by the Mobile StoryCorps booth during its recent stop in Charleston, West Virginia. Their interview and all the conversations in today's show will be housed at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. Next, we'll hear a young woman speak about an experience that sadly too many Appalachians can relate to. She lost her good friend to a drug overdose. Coffee shop owner and barista Bridget Kidd said she really wanted to record a conversation when the StoryCorps project came to West Virginia, so she called up her best friend, Mark Hatfield. Bridget told us later that they didn't plan any questions for their interview, but partway through their conversation, Mark asked Bridget about her experience with grief and finding a way forward about losing a loved one.
If, you know, Bridget right now can tell future Bridget and her first grandkid something through this, what would you tell them?
I feel like our culture, our society is so deeply stressed and, you know, things. And I think that we kind of put a lot more on ourselves here to look at a lot of things more negatively. Just like in my life, like grief, you know, grief here is looked at very negatively a lot of times, you know, or it's looked at to be less powerful whenever,
weak,
whenever, in the sense that in other cultures and other places and people believe differently a lot of times, you know. So it's, I think that just doing what we love and making choices based solely on ourselves and what we want in life is very important.
When have you felt the most broken or like you couldn't get yourself back out of this like hole? You don't have to answer if you don't want to. But
yeah. Probably whenever I lost my partner of 3 years, I lost them to a fentanyl overdose. If something could happen to someone where it was just the worst thing that possibly could happen to them, I think that would be it. I think that that would be the worst, that I felt the most empty. Not necessarily alone, because I wasn't alone in it. You know, he had sisters and, you know, mother and father. But I felt the most confused about life. And, obviously I've known death since a very young age. I've lost my parents, my grandparents, everyone almost around me except for myself. And so whenever you see that much, you know, you go through that much death, I think that I kind of have a hyper sense of just thinking that, you know, truly your energies don't die, but they just transform into something else. So I think that you'll probably meet or see people again, but they won't be the same. Mm-hmm. Do you believe in life after death?
I'm spiritual in the sense that I'm not religious in almost any way. So life after death, to me, I do somewhat believe in like maybe a form of like reincarnation. I don't think that would be reincarnated to a lesser being, so I'm not going to be like punished as an ant in my next life. But I think it's possible, you know, like I may die and then be gone for the next 200 or 300 years, but then my soul will find its way back into something else. And you just constantly, it's a life of like living, and you're learning from each life to your next life.
Okay.
It's just a matter of trying to, like, play off, like, where you were. I have had a past life reading, actually, like, not even a month ago. And she told me some pretty, like, wicked stuff, but I was like, wow,
I remember, yeah. She said that you were, like,
one of them, I was a young girl whose, like, dad died in, like, World War I, and then my mom killed herself, and then my family, like, tried to take care of me. I ended up being a prostitute, getting pregnant by one of the men that I was like in love with. And then he wouldn't leave his wife for me, and I ended up killing myself and left my child. So I don't remember that one, but that's what the cards told her.
So that's what she said. I think we should end it something like this.
Okay,
here we go. If you could say one last thing to me and you never saw me again, what would you say to me?
That I'm super proud of you, and I want you to keep doing what you're doing, to keep your head afloat, to not let yourself get down, and know that you're going to have those shitty days, but you're going to be able to pick yourself back up, and you're going to move forward 10 times harder than you were before.
Okay.
And just know that I would love you forever and always. Mm-hmm. No matter where I'm at, I'm always sending my love to you. So.
Oh, that's sweet. If it was my last time to ever see you, I would say that you've touched my life in ways that you don't even know, and that, you know, hopefully my existence would always be with you, and it would flow through you, and that you are a very brave, strong, and caring person, and I hope that you keep giving that back and doing what you love every day until the end, and I love you very much.
That was Bridget Kidd speaking with her best friend, Mark Hatfield. We're going to take a short break. We'll have more StoryCorps stories when we return, including a conversation between two women who work as raft guides and another from a man who shares his story about growing up without a father. It's just enough time to pull up Inside Appalachia on your smartphone or computer. There you can subscribe to the podcast and get a show delivered every Friday. That way, you can listen on your own time. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Hey, maybe you could help with an upcoming episode we're working on about folk life in Appalachia. What traditions from your friends, family, or community do you have in your life? Could it be digging ramps in the springtime, making your grandmother's bread recipe? Or could it be a new tradition like going to hip-hop shows or independent pro wrestling with your friends? Tell us about your folk life story. Record a voice memo and send it to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. This week, we're listening to a selection of StoryCorps conversations recorded in Charleston, West Virginia, in fall 2018. StoryCorps is a project of National Public Radio where people interview each other about life, love, and events in their life. Some are small, some are significant, but they're all important. Over several weeks, the team recorded 109 interviews with West Virginians. All of these recordings will be archived at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress in the largest collection of oral histories in the world. West Virginia Public Broadcasting had the opportunity to partner with StoryCorps to bring their mobile recording booth to West Virginia, and we're proud to have helped create an invaluable archive for future generations. In this next story, we'll hear from longtime friends Elizabeth Dinkins and Kathy Zirkel, who visited the StoryCorps trailer. The pair share their experiences working as river guides in West Virginia and talk about how the river has influenced them.
I met you after you had already been in the whitewater industry before me, and you were a bit of a legend already in the sense that you were well-known in the community and you were an established leader in the community, and I was not a brand new river guide coming to West Virginia, but I was a river guide that was new to West Virginia and that was interested in learning more about West Virginia. And you were sort of this figure, this known figure. And so in some ways, before we became friends, I sort of looked up to you from a distance to think, like, how did she do that? And what is that about? So tell me how you did that.
Well, I first came to the river community from a different background. I had never worked out of doors. I wasn't an outdoor person. So I was always learning, and I kind of was oblivious to the fact that there were very few women there. I was like a big old sponge and wanted to know how to do different things. And I learned things that are not necessarily river oriented, but things that like they asked me to do that no one ever just questioned that I couldn't do. Like, can you paint that door? Well, yeah, I never said no. And so I didn't notice that I was one of the few women there. Certainly, I ended up getting more respect, I think, because I did more than most men were expected to do. I took the worst cruise. If the boat was flat and didn't have enough air and it was a substandard, I would be the one that took it. I took the heaviest coolers because I knew I had to work twice as hard to be respected. It certainly wasn't fair. I don't think it is ever going to be fair. But I recognized that I needed to work twice as hard to get half the respect. And then from that point forward, I never used my femininity or my sex as an excuse for my poor performance or for the inability to do certain things. And I think that helped win me some respect. And I didn't realize people looked up to me till almost recently, which is kind of weird. So,
how do you think women approach rivers differently than men?
On the outside, it appears that it's a really physical job, and to some extent it is. But I think that the water is a great medium for women to work within because it's very subtle. It does the same thing always. It doesn't matter if you're in California or New England or South America, the water on a river is going to do the exact same thing. And once you learn to, what we say, read the water and understand how it functions, you can just use a little bit of finesse to get you where you need to go. And it allows women, I think, to have a longevity that a lot of men don't have because men come in and they bully the river or they try to overpower it. And if you work with it and understand how it does its thing, you can do it for decades. I'm living proof, you know, 35 years later, I'm still out there every day. And you know, I wake up with aches and pains like anyone else my age, but it's not because of the job that I have.
What do you think makes the river community a tribe or a family?
Whew, that's a tough question. I've asked myself that a bunch. You know, what keeps us together? What's, you know, you and I, you know, we come from completely different backgrounds, our age difference, our educational background, our desires, our hopes, but we are a family. I think it's certainly the environment. I think part of it is when you're out there with other people doing this activity, I know you've got my back in a way that I don't find in any other job or community. You might not even like me, but I know for a fact that if I were in trouble and you were there, you would do everything you could to save me, help me, protect me, and you don't have to like me. And that's kind of a definition of family a little bit, you know?
So in some ways, the river is like the Thanksgiving table that we're all called to, right? We have to be there.
Yeah.
I mean, we're there by choice. We choose it, but we find ourselves right around that table or on the same river or in the same rapid, and we see things happening and we have to respond,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you can't just sit back and let it and watch it go by kind of a thing.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. How does being part of the river community make you more accepting of people that have different lifestyles or different backgrounds?
Well, there's two things I can think of. One is that as a river guide, you know, you take guests down the river. So you see hundreds or thousands of people come across your boats throughout the summer, and you meet them and you get to know them. And it's everything from a church group with kids who've never even been in the woods, much less on a whitewater river, to a family that does a trip, an adventure trip every year. And so you really do run into kind of all walks of life. But then there's the river community factor, which you talked about, like it's kind of like family, you know, you don't get to choose your family. You just get them. In some ways we choose each other because we're self-selecting, right? The river is what binds us, but we're by no means the same. We're all different. I mean, I've worked with individuals who come from radically different backgrounds or even different cultures from me on the river. And then I've also worked with people who are from the local area but have a radically different background. I mean, West Virginia is the most interesting thing, you know, that I've worked with RAF guides who have been coal miners or RAF guides who are college students or RAF guides who, you know, are professional whitewater paddlers and they're sponsored and that's their full life. And so we're all different that way. Also, I think the fact that we're all engaged in the environment is a big part of it. And you learn to talk about different issues that are connected to that environment that are all multi-layered. So I'm thinking about the bus drivers that we've worked with who, you know, told me stories where their sons have jobs in the coal mines. And you know, in the whitewater industry, we think about the environment. We know that coal mining can be dangerous to the environment, but we also know that the job has to happen for that driver's son. And so you value that and you understand that that matters. And you're always recognizing that there's a real human component to this. I don't know that it's taught me to be more accepting of others as much as it has taught me to communicate and listen in different ways.
That was Elizabeth Dinkins speaking with longtime friend and National Park Service River Ranger, Kathy Zirkel. Grief affects everyone differently. I watched as both my mom and aunt lost their husbands. It was devastating on so many different levels. When my dad was killed, it was hard to lean on my family because I knew they were suffering so much already. The next interview features Danny McNeely and Tim Albee talking about what it was like to each lose their previous life partners. Here's Albee.
If you could say you have one regret in life, what would it be and why?
I try to say that I live with no regrets, but if I had to sit down and really think about it, I feel like that almost year that I lost of really knowing my daughter after my partner had killed herself, I was that parent that I swore I'd never be that year. And, you know, pawning her off on the grandparents and staying out all night. You know, I went on 19 days awake one time, partying in my basement. And my daughter looked at me and ran to her room and started crying and screaming. I looked in the mirror and I was pale. But at that time, when I didn't sleep, I didn't have to see that vision of him hanging in our garage. If I can beat that and get through what I did with my partner, I think I can handle almost anything.
If you could have a 5-minute conversation with anybody, past or present, who would it be and why?
Not to go back to, obviously, the relationship. We had a routine. He was a very, he would get up every morning 2 hours before I did. He would get my daughter up. They'd have their little time. He'd cook breakfast. He'd bring her into the bedroom, and he'd lay her next to me. He'd kiss her on the forehead and say, "Princess, Daddy, I'll see you later." And then he'd kiss me on my forehead, and he would say, "My prince, I'll see you later. You have a good day." And then we would sleep for another hour, and I'd get up, and I'd get her ready for preschool. The day that he killed himself, now thinking back, when he kissed me, he kissed her and he said, "Remember, Daddy always loves you." Wow. He never went out of routine. And then when he kissed me, he said, "Don't ever blame yourself and know that I love you and you were the best thing that happened to me." And I didn't catch it because I was halfway asleep. And I blamed myself. And it'd be him and be like, you know, why, like, we had a great life. And it took his dad saying, because he asked me to marry him, and he said, "I can't ask you to be my husband if my family thinks that you're my roommate." And his dad told him that he'd rather have a dead son than a faggot. And it was about 4 months after that, his dad had said that, and then he had killed himself. I just want to know why. Like, just that one question, even if it's not even 5 minutes, just like, why? I'll ask you the same question because it's actually a really good question.
Again, not to go back to the relationship thing.
We're all sappy
but,
today.
Yeah, we're sappy as could be. Hallmark, I hope you're not listening to this.
If you are, cut us a check.
Please. But Eddie and I had our commitment ceremony in 2011. And in 2014, we were told, at that time it was a big issue all over the country of marriage equality, and it was still a state-by-state issue. And on October the 6th, 2014, it passed in Virginia. And I walked into our living room, and he had just woken up from a nap, And he was watching the news, and he said, well, baby, it's now official. It'll be soon here in West Virginia. What do you want to do? And I said, as soon as it's legal, I want to go to the courthouse and get the paperwork done. I said, I don't need another big ceremony. I don't need all of that. I want to just make it legal. And he said, okay. And then he said, well, now we have to do something. And so we were literally making all the plans, and we weren't even married yet. And that night, about midnight, he looked at me. He said, I love you. And I said, I love you too. And he walked upstairs. And for some reason, at 2:30 in the morning, I woke up wide awake. I didn't know why, but I woke up just wide awake. And my little dog, Chloe, that he bought me, she was jumping around and we were playing and everything. And about 3:30, she jumped down off the couch, and I heard her run up the steps to the bedroom. And she let out not even a bark or a yelp, but it was like the most horrendous noise I had ever heard. And I ran upstairs, and he was in bed, and he wasn't moving. He wasn't responsive. I called 911. The paramedics got there, and they worked on him for about an hour. And they said he's been gone since about 2:30. And my first thought was, that was when I woke up. Should I have gone upstairs sooner? But if I had 5 minutes, I would ask him, did I do everything to make you happy? And I would just let him know that I would rather have 5 years of something wonderful than a lifetime of nothing special.
Absolutely. I think that's kind of why maybe we get along very well. We kind of different situations, but
similar history.
Yeah.
Different roads, but similar right. Views.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know what else to say. You done got me all my feels before I have to put on makeup.
Lord. We've done empty out the closets of all the skeletons.
That was Danny McNeely and Tim Albee discussing their grief after losing loved ones. In the next StoryCorps interview, Mike Friel speaks with his friend and colleague Deacon Stone. Stone grew up in a two-bedroom mobile home in southern Ohio in the 80s. Friel asks him about his childhood to learn what it was like to be estranged from his father and then meeting him later on, as well as how it has influenced his own approach to fatherhood.
You've mentioned that you grew up an only child, a single mother. Did you ask your mother about your father, and if so, what would she say?
So Dad wasn't around. That's a nice way of putting it. When I came up, the story was that when I was really, really little, he would come and see me, and she'd kind of like put her foot down, drew her line in the sand, and said, if you want to be part of his life, commit to being part of his life in whatever way. And he always refused to. He just refused to commit to anything. He just wanted to kind of, as she would put it, have his cake and eat it too. And one day he came to see me, and he knocked on the door, and she didn't answer. And that was it. He never came back. That was it. Until I reached the age of 8. And I think looking back on it, it was more out of curiosity than anything. Why wouldn't you want to know, you know, who this human was that you create.
Tell us about that day when you were 8 and how it sort of transpired.
Mom was acting very awkwardly and put on different clothes than she might normally put on and put something nice on. We're going to go somewhere and eat. And going somewhere to eat is, you know, oh, are we going to get roast beef from racks and sit at the boat docks with the windows down? That was eating out. And I thought, oh, nice, we're gonna go somewhere to eat. This must be a special occasion. And we get to McDonald's. And here's this guy, and we sit at the table with him. And she says, this is your dad. And I'm like, oh, okay. All right, I see what's happening here. You know, I'm a little kid. I have no idea.
But you were excited.
I was excited. And he's like, well, hey, how are you? And I'm like, I'm good. It's like, well, you you're growing up. Yeah. You know, like, Mom's like, is there anything you want to ask your dad? And I sat there for the longest time, and I think the only thing I could muster was, do you have any pets? And I don't even...
And did he?
And if we had any pets. I don't recall. I don't think he did. It was just a very, very peculiar circumstance. So then we go to the flea market, and he buys me a dartboard. He gave me the scroll with the book of Matthew written in tiny text and bolded in such a way that Jesus' face appears when you look at it. And he gives me a... he gave me the dartboard, and he gave me $20. And I mean to tell you, I thought he was the most fantastic person in the universe. And here I am drawing crayon pictures, and he's supposedly traveling back and forth from Florida to Ashland, Kentucky, right down the road from us. And he's going to move back, and this is why Mom agreed to let him meet me. And, you know, in that process, I'm going back to Florida. I'm getting my stuff and moving back, and I'm drafting these letters, and my mom sees him, and she's like, you know, I really don't know. I don't know what's going to happen here. And I know she was trying to protect me, like, emotionally, because I was just overwhelmed at this larger-than-life imagined figure in my head, my dad. It was now I had a connection there. And she was very judicious about it, but she asked me to kind of sit on the letters for a while. And I don't regret that, because I never sent those letters. And the funny thing was, he, at that time, wasn't moving back anyway. He had just told her what he needed to tell her to see me and get his curiosity out of his system, and that was it. I didn't speak to my dad again until I was in my 20s, when, again, out of curiosity on my part, I wound up looking him up.
So today, you're married to Jessica, and you have two children of your own. How do you think your background or the way that you were raised affects the type of spouse, the type of father that you are today?
I have doubts every day about being a dad, having never had one. And I know we all have different kinds of figures of influence in our life that don't necessarily directly advise the decisions we make and the behaviors we have. But I have doubts every day, and I suppose at this point in my journey, I've leaned into it in the full understanding that I really think on the base level, none of us really know what we're doing anyway, but we are all at best doing our best. And that's been enough pressure off of the situation and enough consideration to it to make sure that I feel like showing up really is 90% of the game, you know? And I'm glad that I'm there for my kids. Do I always wish that, you know, I had some stellar example of how to be an awesome dad? I guess, but that's, you know, that's just imagination. Reality is I do my best every day, and I really hope that that's good enough. It's better than some I've seen.
That was Mike Friel and Deacon Stone. The story comes from Karen Ireland and Roger May. They discuss the effects the water crisis and opioid addiction epidemic in West Virginia have had on their relationship. Ireland has long advocated for clean water. May is the director of Looking at Appalachia, a crowdsourced photo archive of the region. Both are community activists.
Yeah, about that argument this morning. No, just kidding.
Yeah, seriously.
Well, it was about this. It was. Well, it wasn't really about this. It was...
I just feel like so much pressure all the time. Like, that's what I was thinking about when I was in Genevieve's appointment this morning. Just, like, there's so much pressure all the time.
Right.
And do you feel that way? I mean, like, I'm trying to figure out if any of that is because I'm a mom and a woman with kids at home, or...
Right.
Do you feel pressure?
I think I feel pressure. I don't know if I feel it all the time, and I certainly don't think I feel it at the level... that you do. And maybe it manifests itself differently in me. I didn't really think this was at the core of the little blow up this morning, but I knew that by the time I got to work, I wanted to text you and say I was sorry. So.
I appreciate that. I guess I just feel like literally when I was sitting out there filling out the form, and then I thought, oh my gosh, I've had to pee for like 40 minutes. And just like sometimes my day is such that I feel like I can't, it, like I'm just getting by
right
under the wire. And
yeah, just running from one thing to the next and forgetting to pee along the way.
Yeah. I guess, you know, you'd mentioned talking about the water crisis, and that for me was like, I feel like every time I've ever been recorded, it's been about the water crisis. But actually, there's a lot to talk about there, so sure. I'd be fine with that. Do you think the water crisis played a role in you and I? In you and me?
Yeah.
In me and you?
In us? Yeah, I think so. Even though we didn't even know each other.
We were like ships passing in the night.
That's right. Ships passing in the contaminated drinking water.
That's right.
And I don't know if we had even met then that things would have turned out the way they did.
Right.
You know, I mean, you were full on into advocating and organizing. I was living in another state and here on an assignment, overwhelmed by what I saw and the stories I heard, and I was only here for a handful of days. For me, that's when I knew that I knew that I knew that I had to come back to West Virginia. Because when I left here and I was driving back to North Carolina, it's only 300 miles, but it may as well have been 3,000 miles. And I thought, I'm going to go home and I'm going to take a hot shower and I'm going to drink clean water from the tap and I'm going to go back to my day job and I'm going to go back to life as usual. And there are 300,000 people just a few hours away that are unable to do the same thing.
I was also thinking earlier that West Virginia, like as much as it brings us together, I was thinking, God, what if it, like, what if one of us wants to leave? I mean, this opioid thing's really getting to me.
Yeah.
I don't know how you feel about it, but today, for a brief moment, I'm like, I wonder what jobs are in Lexington or, I mean, I don't want to move, you know, I don't want to move, but I'm exhausted by it. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I certainly don't want to move, and I think the argument could be made that almost no place is untouched by the opioid epidemic. We just happen to see it.
There are places less touched.
True. I don't know. I hope it allows us to appreciate things of beauty more and stories, and there are other good things happening here. It's all kind of happening under the banner of this very dark cloud that, you know, and I don't even know if there's an end in sight, you know.
Yeah.
But I would hate to think that we would need to leave in order to, you know, stay above water.
But I definitely have gotten to the point where I want the kids to go. And I think that I wasn't that way before. And now I think, because it isn't just that the problem is magnified. I mean, the problem is, it's worse here. I want to acknowledge that it hit us harder. And so having the kids here and like them being vulnerable in terms of, I mean, they're teenagers. And it makes me feel like, am I putting them at risk more here than someplace with more, I mean, I'm not leaving. I'm just saying this stuff has started to weigh on my mind a little bit.
But I think it's important that we eventually find a way to listen to, you know, kids when they say, I want to leave. And we should find out why that is. And we should also be willing to listen to kids that say, I want to stay, and give them a reason to stay, you know, and if they're here to support them staying.
Anything else you want to talk about?
Before? I just want to go on record to say that I did start to fall in love with you at the Hinton Dairy Queen, even though it was our first date that wasn't really a date.
It was platon.
For you, maybe. But for me, on this side of the table, it was more than that.
Here we are. I mean, we love each other now.
That's right. Even if I loved you first. Right. At the Hinton Dairy Queen.
I really do love that Dairy Queen.
I do too.
We should go back.
We should.
Okay.
On this show, we listen to Appalachians share their own stories in their own words. In these stories, I heard a level of authenticness in their voices. It wasn't without struggle or pain. The real stories from Appalachia come with blemishes and darkness. Unfortunately, we heard moments of racism and opioid addiction and just pure heartache. But in these voices, I also heard more than just the statistics of how many people died or how they voted. I heard sincere concern for their children, their neighbor, their partners, and their friends. And I heard love in action. If you look for it, you'll find hate. But if you look for love, you'll find that too. When we lose a loved one, sometimes the only thing you have to hold on to is your memory. It's the one thing that no one can take away from you. And that's the whole point of these recordings. They're captured for posterity, but also to solidify those memories for our families and future generations. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Caitlin Tan, Brittany Patterson, and Shayla Klein. Music in today's show was provided by Bob Thompson, Alan Cathead Johnston, Spencer Elliott, and Dinosaur Burps. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. Send us an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org or address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget, you can subscribe or download all of our stories on iTunes, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.